Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 185, entitled How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness, I chat with Dr. Rick Hansen. Dr. Rick Hansen is a psychologist, senior fellow of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, and a New York Times bestselling author. In today's episode, Dr. Rick talks about cultivating the techniques for controlling your mind and emotions, even when you face stress, obstacles, or chaos from the world around you. He blends years of empirical guidance with cutting-edge science and shares a multitude of practical and profound steps to take in order to master your mental game. Dr. Rick delivers the goods in this powerful interview and shows us exactly how to develop an inner peace and power that most people unfortunately lack. If you're wondering how to grow an unshakable core of calm, strength, and happiness, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, I've got some really exciting news. After a couple of years of hard work, brainstorming, and calculating a number of avenues to make this possible, I'm happy to announce the Elite Man Brotherhood is just a few weeks away. That's right, the one group that will take you to the next level both personally and professionally and help you become the best man you can be. This is a premium group where I'll be sharing my hands-on techniques, tips, and processes for helping you become a better man personally, professionally, and socially. I'll be giving you the same type of guidance only found in world-class coaches who charge tens of thousands of dollars each month for similar assistance. Seriously, my team and I have wanted to have a group like this for a while, one where we'd be able to help more guys like you in a more active and dynamic fashion, but due to a number of logistics and the timing of a multitude of other commitments, it's been delayed. But delayed no more. We're ready to unleash this incredible group and have you kicking serious ass in just a few weeks. No more hang-ups, no more waiting around for that big break, no more missing out on dates, no more feeling like crap all the time, and no more skating by and living the life of mediocrity that so many men unfortunately live. With the Elite Man Brotherhood, we will be taking you through the gauntlet and helping you overcome your greatest challenges in life. I cannot wait for this. If you're as excited about the Brotherhood as I am, go to elitemanmagazine.com/survey and answer a one-question survey about what you want to see me include in this group before we launch. I want to know exactly what you'd like the group to have so I can better fit the group structure to your needs. Also, if you answer this one-question survey, you'll get an extra 10% off our lowest price when we go live in a couple of weeks. But act now, as this offer is literally expiring just a couple weeks after this podcast airs. Again, help me tailor the Elite Man Brotherhood to better fit you and get a bonus 10% off our launch day price right now by going to elitemanmagazine.com/survey. That's elitemanmagazine.com/survey. I've been using Harry's razors now for a few months, and I have to say, these shavers are some of my all-time favorites. The closeness of the shave, the comfortable and smooth glide, the fresh design, it's nothing short of epic. I love using these blades, and they make lining up my beard 1,000 times easier. I've talked about Harry's in the past, and I'm telling you again, they are the real deal when it comes to shaving. I love them. And I know you're going to love them too. And because Harry stands by their blades and wants to show you guys just how awesome they are too, they created a special Elite Man trial offer for you. You can claim your trial offer by going to harrys.com/eliteman. This exclusive trial set comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/eliteman. Make sure you go to harrys.com/eliteman to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Dr. Rick Hansen from RickHansen.net, and that is H-O-H-A-N-S-O-N. There's a few other Rick Hansens out there, but this is the one Rick Hansen that we're talking to today, and I'm a big fan of his, and he just came out with a book several months back called Resilient, which I want to dive into today primarily. It's called How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness, which is a pretty profound topic. But Rick, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate your time.
Justin, really, I'm happy to be here. What you're doing is great, and I am just honored to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So you've actually, I mentioned your book a minute ago, and I talked about it in the intro as well. But you also have a few other books that are like huge bestsellers. One called Buddha's Brain, another called Hardwiring Happiness. And all your books have a fundamental concept of changing your inner belief, your inner emotions, your feelings. And it all starts really upstairs in the brain. And
yeah,
I'm curious myself, man, how did you get, because you've been a psychologist for many, many years, but how did you get into this type of work particularly? I'm sure it was decades ago, right?
Yeah. In a weird way, when I look back, it was when I was a teenager. Honestly, I was grew up in a basically normal environment, no terrible things, and a lot of stress and unhappiness and craziness in my family. And I was also really young going through school, and I was lonely and neurotic and awkward and just miserable. And somewhere in my teens, I know this was around the time I was reading Dune, the classic science fiction novel, whose main character was 15 at the time. And I remember thinking, yeah, we're about the same age. It just super hit me. Like one of those moments where you just kind of get it. You're really miserable. You're really unhappy. It seems hopeless. And then you realize, hey, whatever has been about the past and however I feel in the moment, I can still develop myself from here. I can heal. I can grow. It's everything you're into. I can become more skillful. I can learn how to talk to girls. I can learn how to deal with my parents. I can learn how to manage my weird reactions to things. There's actual hope. I can develop muscles, in a sense, psychologically over time. And that just changed everything for me. It created a whole new context. It was like every day I could do this. Every day I could learn a little thing. I could become a little stronger, become a little wiser, become a little happier, become a better person every day. And each day that little increment was going to be bit by bit, but over time it would add up to something big. And so that's what set me on my way, really. And then related to that, I had a insight that if learning broadly is what's most important from wherever you are going into the future, then learning how to learn is the strength of strengths, because it's the one that grows the rest of them. So it became really important to me to understand how people actually change for the better, how the change process actually happens. That led me into the human potential movement. I went to college in the early 70s, also led me into mindfulness and meditation and the Eastern traditions. And then it eventually led me into official psychology and then neuropsychology. Based upon all those different threads, I started writing books around 15 years ago. So that's kind of brings us up to the present. So that's what got me into this. Like a lot of people, I was hurting on the inside, and then I stumbled across these methods, which I now understand what they're doing to our brains, that we can use every day to fill ourselves up from the inside out with good inner resources that we can take with us wherever we go.
Yeah, I love your story, and I resonated with it a lot myself. It took me to about the age of 17 or so. I had really bad anxiety and panic attacks and depression, but around that age, I figured out that if I do these certain things, if I take some specific steps and take actions, I have control over my mind. I have control over my feelings and emotions. Am I doing certain things? I was able, I mean, it took a little while to figure it out. It took about a year or so to really like get in touch with things.
Mm-hmm.
But from that point forward, I've carried this sort of inner strength with me in these abilities to control, you know, my feelings in different situations. Kind of sounds the same in your aspect as well.
Yeah, 100%. You grew strengths inside, or in the fancy psychological term, you grew resources inside. And what's interesting, and I hope we get into it, is that these days in psychology, there's a growing recognition of the importance of identifying or recognizing your inner resources, like grit, resilience, determination, compassion, self-compassion, confidence. These are inner resources. Happiness is an inner resource. There's a lot of focus on identifying them and using them, but it leaves out a huge question. How do we acquire them in the first place? How do you grow them, especially so you have them with you when the going gets rough and you carry them with you wherever you go? So that's really neat that you came across that right about the age I did too. And that's our, to me, really a fascinating topic. How do we actually grow these strengths so that they're lasting? You know, that's what I hope we get into.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that actually in a minute. It seems to me, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get this all the time too when I come across people now. They tell me that I'm very calm, I'm very kind of relaxed and content with life.
Yeah.
And it was so opposite to like 10 years ago how I used to be. I'm sure you get that, because I'm looking at you now and you just seem very, very chill, very calm, happy, content. Do you get that as well? Like, have you had that all your life, those questions?
Right. I think probably my version of it is, or you get it, people go, well, I can't believe, I mean, I understand the words, but really? And but it's really hopeful. We really can grow from the inside out, not putting on a better mask. A lot of people frame growth as top down or outside in, or just put on a shinier false face. And that's BS. Sooner or later, it'll wear you down. And other people will see through it. And I do get that about you. And I can sense in you what I call calm strength, that kind of inner core. That is what we need to draw upon, not just for chilling out on a Saturday afternoon. That's easy. But what do we draw on when the waves of life come at us? What's that deep keel in the water that we grow over time that helps us manage the waves and have the confidence and the courage to go out and sail the deep, dark blue, because we know we can deal with it when the storms come? That's the key question. And I can sense in you that you've grown that, and enables a person, in this case you, and in my own way me, to stay happy even as we deal with challenges.
Yeah.
Right? It's easy to be happy when everybody's telling you what a great guy you are with 5-star reviews, right? But when oatmeal hits the fan, can you still stay happy in the core of your being?
Yeah. Like we're talking about here, it has built up a resilience in me that I didn't have before. I actually went through these experiences, and at the time they were horrible, but they were a blessing in disguise, because it has shaped me and who I am, and actually the path that I ended up going down in my life, and to, you know, help other people get over it. But the big thing is the resilient aspect, the resiliency, the toughness, the inner calm. I mean, it's an inner calm, but it's also a inner calm that leads to strength and toughness, like we talked about.
Yeah.
How do you help guys get those things we're talking about, the grit, the strength, the resiliency? Where does that come from, and how can guys acquire that before actually trying to apply it? Because you said there's a big missing piece there, and it's the actual getting of that. How do we obtain that?
Yeah, how do you get it? That's a great question. So a bit of framework here. About a third of who we are psychologically is rooted in our DNA. It's grounded in our genetics. It's innate. That's the third we really can't do anything about. We can compensate for it. We can use it. But we can't change it. It's baked into our genes. The other two-thirds, roughly, of who we become is based on other factors. How the world deals with us, what it does to us, how we respond to that, and what we do inside our own minds. That means roughly that about two-thirds of the strengths that a person has, the calm, the resilience, the happiness, the wisdom that a person has, is acquirable. That's really hopeful. And it goes to responsibility, because if we can acquire it, it's on us to do what we can every day, bit by bit, realistically, to grow the good inside ourselves. So that's the larger frame. In terms of the balance, it's called sometimes, you've heard it, nature and nurture. Roughly about a third on average of the variation in who people are is due to nature. The other two-thirds is due to nurture, broadly defined, which means including how you nurture yourself. So that's the opportunity for us. So then the question is, it's really useful to me to work backwards. So let's say a guy wishes he had more confidence in different situations, at work, with friends, with women, okay? Or let's suppose a person wanted to have more self-control of their temper. Like, even though I'm a pretty chill guy, I have a temper. I've come to really learn that. I really learned it when we had little kids, and I really learned I needed to get the brakes. I needed to grow a thicker brake pad inside myself. So let's suppose that's what you want to develop. Here's the deal. If you want to have it with you in a lasting way, it means you've got to develop it as a trait, as a durable personal quality. That's distinct from a passing state. So it's kind of like the difference between somebody gives you some money, that's a state. What you have in the bank, that's a trait. That's what you own. That's what you have with you. And a lot of the focus in positive psychology is on experiencing groovy states, useful thoughts, fine, useful good ideas. But always the question is, what's the lasting value? What are the residues left behind? And the dirty little secret in so much psychology and coaching and self-help and pop psychology and mindfulness training is that most people's experiences have no lasting value. They wash right through the brain. They don't leave a physical trace behind. And that's what really I focus on, how to turbocharge, how to steepen your growth curve as you move through life in general. And then when you know how to do that, you can grow anything you want inside yourself. So that's the real bottom line. How do you change your brain for the better from the inside out in a way that's lasting rather than some kind of fast food that passes through you, but you're the same old asshole the next day, or you're as impatient as ever the next day, or you're as neurotic or anxious or feeling inadequate or awkward the next day. How do you actually change your brain for the better in a way that lasts? So that's what we could talk about, the how of that, but I'm super practical about it.
Yeah, I love that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you see so many people, especially in the self-help world, the self-help industry. I love self-help. I got a million self-help books on the shelf and you know, I like to show them off sometimes and people come over, but you know, a lot of people collect self-help books, the audio books, video courses, programs, they go to seminars, all this other stuff. And they get all this wisdom, they acquire all this knowledge, but like you said, it doesn't last. It's very fleeting, it's transient, it's here one day, gone the next, because they don't absorb it, they're not actually implementing it, it's not something they practice on a daily basis and make it part of their life, and so it comes and goes. But what you're talking about is building a true structure, a system of things that actually, like you said, is part of your bank, that's part of like your traits, and it becomes a part of who you are. So let's talk about that. How do we make that transition from getting all this great information to actually keeping this information and then applying it into our lives?
Yeah, and let's be clear what we're talking about. Part of what we're talking about is ideas, but ideas are easy to learn quickly. You can learn an idea and an information really quickly. It's different to learn happiness or to learn a sense of self-worth, or to learn skills like how to interact with other people. That's more fundamental, and it takes more time to do that. So the question is how to help that, those moods and ways of experiencing every day, and also skills with other people and situations, how to help that really land inside. So the way that happens is in two simple but necessary steps. The first step is we begin with an experience of whatever we want to grow. To use a weird metaphor, it's like the brain is an iPod. So first you have to get the song playing. So if you want to, for example, grow confidence, you have to experience confidence or something related to it, something that supports it, like feeling liked by another person. That builds confidence. Feeling appreciated by other people. That supports a sense of confidence. Or seeing something good about yourself, recognizing, hey, I don't totally suck. I have good intentions. Hey, I try hard. Hey, I get knocked down, but then I stand up again. Hey, I keep going. Hey, I hold back when I don't hit people. Like I don't mistreat other people. I don't walk around being an asshole. Hey, those are opportunities to experience something that supports a sense of worth. Supports a sense of confidence. Okay, so we start with getting the song playing in the inner iPod. But that's all that most people ever do. That's all that most self-help or psychotherapy or coaching, mindfulness training, whatever, that's all they do. They help people have an experience in the moment. Great, but there's no recorder turned on. That song is not recorded. It doesn't become part of a person. It doesn't get put in the bank. And that's where, in the second step, you need to engage your brain. Good news, it's easy to engage your brain so that the experiences you're having over the course of a breath or two or three actually leave a lasting physical trace behind. The bad news is you have to focus to do it. And you have to do it. Otherwise, you're going to leave all that money on the table. So let me give you, want me to give you an example or two about that?
Yes, it seems like the most important step of them all is the engaging part, because that's really what brings it all in, right?
100%. There are different terms you can use in neurological language. There's encoding, step one. Step two is consolidation. Or I call it activation is step one. Getting the song playing. Installation is step two. Or internalization is step two. Or a nice simple way to remember it is step one is the state, the feeling, the thought, the body sensation, the action, the intention. Step one is a state. Step two is the trait. You're trying to grow the trait. Traits are what you take with you wherever you go. The conditions change around you. People disappoint. Situations can fall apart. The traits you carry with you are what you can count on in the most important minutes and days of your life.
Okay. So what is the
how do you do it?
Example of that. Yeah. How do you go?
Oh, I gotta go. I'm really sorry, Justin. I gotta beat it. No, I'm kidding. I'm stringing you along here. Well, let me. And also, I want to be really clear. It's funny, like the context. You know, I'm a therapist. I'm a meditator. I'm a nice guy on the one hand. On the other hand, man, oh man, the framework for me about all this is very tough-minded. It recognizes how challenging life is, how often people will let you down. Not everybody, but most people tend to disappoint eventually. And also, we'll get into a little bit later, as a psychologist, I've learned about what scientists call the negativity bias of the brain. I call it, it's like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. So to deal with just life in general and to compensate for the brain's negativity bias, we really need to grow strengths inside. So even though I'm a nice guy, there's something very tough-minded and at the bottom here, as you and I are talking about, really the essence of self-reliance. So that's the framework here.
Can we pause for a sec? I want to actually dive into the negativity bias. It was one of my questions. Let's just mention it. Yeah. What is it exactly?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
The short version, to experience that, imagine you're in a relationship with your boss, your partner, your friend. 10 things happen in a day. 9 are positive. 1's negative. What do you remember when you're falling asleep? What do you obsess about? What do you want to write an email about at 2 in the morning? What really irritates you? What moves the needle? What affects the relationship? For example, I'm dealing with someone right now I've known for quite a while, mainly positively, but recently they've just gone off the rails. And that's very consequential. So the result of the reason for the negativity bias in evolution is that our ancestors, we're talking 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system sitting on life before that. So they needed to get carrots and avoid sticks. Carrots like food, mating opportunities. Sticks like, I say to my wife, hey, honey, how about a mating opportunity? But I haven't ever done that. That would be a little weird. But anyway, I go nowhere. Sticks like predators or aggression between bands or inside bands. And here's the difference, though. If you don't get a carrot today, you'll have a chance of one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whack, no more carrots forever. So the brain, I'll just riff through it, does these 5 things automatically. And you can see it in your own experience as you move through your day. 1, we scan for bad news. We're always scanning for bad news around us, in our bodies, even in our minds, in relationships. What could go wrong? What's missing? Where's the pain? Who's mad at me now? Where are they? I don't know where my kids are. They could get killed. Scan for bad news. 2, we overreact. We focus upon it. As soon as anything goes wrong, that's all we see. And we lose sight of the big picture. That's why positive emotions and well-being in general helps us see the big picture. 3rd thing that happens, we overreact to it. People react more to losing something than to gaining the same thing. People react more to pain than to pleasure. We overreact to it. The brain reacts more intensely. 4th, that whole package is immediately fast-tracked into memory. Once burned, twice shy. So we remember negative information about others more than positive information. Gossip really sinks in. Attack ads in politics really sink in. Negative interactions with other people, like I was saying in my story about this person in my life recently, those affect relationships more than positive interactions do. That's why if you want to have a you know, long-term successful relationship with a friend or a romantic partner or someone who works for you, the positive interactions from that person's perspective need to really outnumber the negative ones from their perspective. Research originally said 5-to-1 ratio, positive to negative. There's no exact right number. Just the point, though, is think back in the last 24 hours with your partner or your kid. From their perspective, ballpark, what's the ratio of good to bad in their encounters with you? That's a real humbling, cautionary moment. Anyway, that's the fourth thing the brain does, over-remembers the negative. And then the fifth thing it does last is that it gradually becomes sensitized to the negative through the stress hormone cortisol, which is released when we're just irritated or stuck in traffic or worried about something or juggling too many tasks at once. Cortisol goes into the brain. It sensitizes a part of the brain called the amygdala. There are two of them. It's like an ancient little alarm bell in your brain, literally the size of an almond, two of them. And the amygdala then gets increasingly sensitized by irritating, stressful, frustrating experiences so that it reacts more intensely down the road. Simultaneously, cortisol kills neurons or weakens them in the hippocampus, a different part of the brain. Again, two of them. The hippocampus looks like a little seahorse. That's the origin of its name, next to the almond-shaped amygdala. And the hippocampus puts things in context, helps you see the big picture, and it calms down the amygdala. It inhibits it, puts the brakes on it, says, hey, chill. Also, the hippocampus tells the hypothalamus, another part of your brain, there's just one of them. That means it's really ancient and fundamental, deep in the center of your brain. And it's sort of a master regulator of drives and reactions. And the hippocampus tells the hypothalamus, quit calling for stress hormones. Enough already. War's over. So you can see the vicious cycle. Irritating, frustrating, hurtful experiences today make us a little more vulnerable to them tomorrow, a little more sensitive to them, a little more prickly or reactive to them, a little more thin-skinned tomorrow, which then increases the likelihood of even more stressful experiences tomorrow, which makes us even more reactive to them the day after that in a vicious cycle. This is Mother Nature's plan, these five things. They work well in Jurassic Park or back on the Serengeti Plains. And if you're in a combat tour in the Middle East, they're useful there, or you're growing up in what feels like a combat zone, okay. We're tough critters, but most of the time, for most people in the modern world today, this negativity bias makes us more upset than we need to be, wears on our physical health, lowers performance, distracts us from these negative through these negative reactions, wears on our self-worth and our happiness and our well-being, and creates a lot of trouble in our intimate relationships. And you can see scaled up at the level of politics, groups banging on each other. It creates vicious cycles of conflict between groups that go all the way to war. With terrible things and atrocities along the way. So that's the negativity bias. Again, like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good.
That is really, really fascinating. A lot of these, the five things, I mean, every one of them was really interesting and just fascinating. As a survival mechanism, it seems like these things are incredibly beneficial. Like they will save your life. The overreaction of, you know, putting your hand into a fight, you're never going to do that again. Becoming sensitized over time, again, you're going to be cautioned against going against something that could potentially harm you. Interesting, though, you brought up a couple of cool interesting things with the desensitization of the cortisol and how it actually can damage the hippocampus. I've read actually some studies, some recent ones, that have linked cortisol, constant stress, essentially, to early dementia and causing symptoms of early dementia. Just like the stress alone, because of what you said, and it makes a lot of sense to me, the cortisol desensitizing and actually killing off neurons in that part of the brain.
Yeah, I saw that you had interviewed Dale Bredesen, for example. Yeah, about early preventing Alzheimer's. Yeah, exactly. So just to, I probably said a lot of things really fast there. Cortisol, it sensitizes the amygdala and it weakens the hippocampus. So it actually overstimulates neurons in the hippocampus and then they die eventually. So in that sense, it does desensitize or deactivate, really, the hippocampus, small technical point. But you're right, cortisol is inflammatory. And that inflammation happens in the brain and well as a factor in early dementia. You're totally right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other interesting thing too is the effect it has on the amygdala. So I know a lot of people who have anxiety, once it starts to happen, it's like it gets worse and worse because it's a vicious cycle, because it's just, like you said, it's lowering the sensitization or the desensitization of the amygdala's ability to function.
Yeah.
And man, it just makes a lot of sense. And you wonder why these things are happening, why people are getting anxiety, why it's getting worse, and why so many people are getting it. And then you think back to something like the negativity bias, and it makes a lot of sense. The other thing, too, that comes to mind is, studies kind of vary on the number, but between like 70 to say 80 to 90%, some really depressed people, 70 to 90% of their thoughts a day typically tend to be negative or non-productive thoughts.
Yeah. So, yeah, that would ring totally true to what I know. Yeah.
It goes right along with this negativity bias. It's people are always having this just negative cycle going on in their head, and it's leading to a lot of problems, physical and emotional.
Yeah. No, you're really well informed. It's great. There's this traditional saying, your mind takes its shape from what it rests upon.
Yeah.
And right there is the modern update would be your brain takes its shape. From literally physically at the molecular and cellular level, your brain takes its shape physically, literally, from where your mind is rested routinely. And to be crystal clear, this does not mean that we should suppress or fight or deny our negative, quote unquote, thoughts and feelings. If you do that, they just get worse. If you resist them, they grow stronger. The key, though, is to step back from them and have a kind of internal circuit breaker or shock absorber that enables you to step back from those negative thoughts and feelings so that you don't reinforce them in the process. That said, the other thing, a lot of people, like you're saying there, Justin, they feed their negative thoughts. They follow them. They get into them. They ruminate about them. They dwell there. And because their mind is now rested on those negative thoughts, that gradually, as you were saying, shapes their brain in a negative way. I mean, to put it in kind of simple language, I find myself really asking this question for myself a lot and for other people. Where do you dwell and what's in your heart? And where you dwell is what gradually fills your heart. Right.
I love it.
Yeah. It really cuts right to the chase, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you mentioned a good point, too, with the fact that you don't want to resist it. I mean, that's why your book's not called Resist. It's called it's called Resilient. You want to be able to withstand all that life throws your way and not, you know, try to resist it or try to suppress it or hide from it or any of that stuff, but be tough enough to stand there and take it and continue on. And actually, in my experience, get stronger from that fact. So diving back into what we're talking about early as far as the implementation of it, the engaging in your brain, how does that work? What is the step for that?
Yeah, a great summary of a lot of this stuff comes from this Canadian psychologist, Donald Hebb, working back in the 1940s and 1950s, like a while back there. And the saying is, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Yes.
More and more people have heard that. Yeah, you've heard it. So it's more complicated than that. That's a great summary. The longer they're firing together, the more intensely they're firing together, the more in a whole body way they're firing together, the more rewarding, positive, pleasurable, enjoyable it feels when they fire together, the more they're going to tend to wire together. So maybe I'll walk through a little example here. Let's suppose a person works backward. You know, if you have a flat tire, putting more gas in your tank is not going to help. So what works is to identify what are the resources that would help you. Let's say a person's anxious, learning how to kind of find a way to calm down and see threats accurately and see your capabilities so you're not so overwhelmed by the challenges, for example, is helpful. Or feeling inside yourself that people like you and that you are likable and that you carry them with you where you go. That's a very fundamental form of strengthening yourself from the inside out. For example, research shows that guys going on combat tours, women as well, do better and are less likely to get PTSD if they have an internal experience of a sense of belonging to their team or their platoon or their unit, a strong sense of camaraderie and affiliation that protects their bodies and their brains and their minds against terrible things that happen around them. So let's suppose you want to grow these things. You know what you want to grow, right? Know what you want to grow, right? And then look for chances to experience it, to feel it, to think it, to know it, to feel it. And then when you do, turn on the inner recorder. And here are, I could go into a lot of detail about this. I think I'll skip the detail and just cut to the chase here. I'll tell you three things you can do. Any one of them really will help change your brain for the better. And the more you do them, and the more of them you do, like anything, it's like physical fitness, really. We're talking about mental fitness here, makes a difference. First, keep the experience going for a breath or longer. That's easy to remember. Stay with it. And people, if you watch your mind closely, think of all those little moments we're having in a day where something good is happening. It's probably mild, but it's real. It's not less than what it is, but it's not more than what it is, but it's not less than what it is. So there's a moment of friendliness with somebody, you're goofing around with a guy at the deli, or you get something done, or your boss gives you a compliment, or you're listening to a Lee Van podcast and you get a cool insight and you're like, yeah, that's right. So stay with it. And it's astonishing to watch your mind, even though it's good, you know it's good. You also often you worked for it, right? You worked for it and you don't stay with it for more than a half second. You move on, you change the channel real quickly. In our modern, media age, we get distracted. We're kind of trained to always want some new stimulation. Instead of all that, hey man, guard the gold for a breath, 6 seconds, 10 seconds, half a minute. Keep those neurons firing together inside yourself. It'll feel good while you do it, and that'll help your brain change for the better. So that's the first suggestion. And the second suggestion is anytime you're having one of these experiences, usually because it's already happening, occasionally because you deliberately think of something that creates an experience. Like you deliberately think of something you're thankful for, or see me, I have a long background as a rock climber in wilderness and in mountains. You draw on, let's say in my case, you pull up the body memory, what it feels like in your body to pull over an overhang when you have to deal with someone and assert yourself, who's somebody who's coming at you aggressively, say. So sometimes you create the experience, usually because it's already happening. All right. So second thing you can do once you're experiencing it is feel it in your body. The more embodied the experience, the deeper the trace it's going to leave. And men in particular, to generalize, tend to be up in their head. I sure was. I was numb from the neck down when I landed in, college. And we need to wake down, not just wake up. So including the sense in your body, the emotions. Nobody needs to know what you're feeling. What's cool about this, another thing that's good about it, is that it's private and it's autonomous. It's under your control and it's private. Outwardly, you can look stoic and all warrior-like. Inwardly, you can be feeling really happy inside that people do like you, and you can let that really sink in. So second suggestion, feel it in your body as much as possible. Move from the idea to the feeling. And then the third thing that you can do that really works is to focus on what's rewarding about the experience. What feels good about it? What's enjoyable? What's pleasurable? Or what's important and meaningful to you? And technically what that will do is increase activity of norepinephrine and dopamine, two important neurotransmitter systems that will flag the experience as a keeper and protection in long-term storage. There are other things you can do. My material that you've kindly told people about, I have lots of free stuff on my website. You can check it out. I'm pretty out there in the public space in terms of these methods. My book, Resilient, Hardwiring Happiness, both of them really go into the detail. But the essence, I think, is really simple. Have it, enjoy it. Have the useful experiences, and then don't waste them on your freaking brain. Enjoy it. Take in the good. Why not? Don't leave all that money lying on the table. And three major ways to actually enjoy it and take it in is to extend the duration of these individual experiences, feel them in your body, and focus on what's rewarding about them.
Hey, just a reminder, if you haven't gone yet, head over to EliteManMagazine.com/survey and tell me exactly what you want to see the Elite Man Brotherhood have. I'm so excited about this group and have been working on crafting it together now for the past couple of years. Man, I'd really love to hear what you want most out of this group and would love to see you become a part of it. This group is for you and for taking you to the next level. So head on over to EliteManMagazine.com/survey right now and take the one question survey to let me know exactly how to create the ultimate group to help you reach your goals. Again, that's EliteManMagazine.com/survey, and by answering the one question on there, you'll guarantee yourself an extra 10% off the lowest price possible. But act now before we go live in a few weeks. This offer will be gone when we launch. Again, that's EliteManMagazine.com/survey. So say someone is listening to the podcast now and they want to learn this whole concept. They want to apply it. How long do you recommend they focus on the experience of taking it all in? Like the first step is just kind of taking it in for a couple extra seconds, a breath or two. The other one is feeling it in your body. And then the third one is focusing on what's rewarding about the experience. For the second and third steps, how long is that process? Is that like a couple minutes, or is it like a full day, or is it?
Oh no. Really talking about, and also realistically, what will people actually do?
Yeah, exactly.
So the way to think of it is in terms of episode or moment. So I'll give you an example. You're arguing with your wife, my wife, and you realize, whoa, it's just going to go better from now on if I, do A instead of B, right? And you want to try to help that land. So the next time things get heated, you do A instead of B, right? So you want to help yourself so that you get it. So in that moment, you would want to flag, okay, there's learning here. There's an opportunity for me to gain something. And I want to really register it. I want to help it land so it's rooted. And the next time this happens, it's a trait. It's inside me. So you would stay with it like I'm describing. I use the measure of a breath because people can be aware of the breath. 20 seconds in a row. That's what I'm really talking about. Most of these episodes are really brief, and which sharpens the point that it's bizarre and amazing and tragic, actually, that we don't take the 10 seconds or the 20 seconds half a dozen times a day. That's less than 5 minutes a day, spread out over a day, that I'm really talking about here. You can add to the impact if there are particular times in your day, like after you meditate or after a workout or a run, or you walk the dog, or at a meal, or just before sleep, or maybe connected to some kind of religious life you have, which is real and important for many people. At those particular moments, at the end of a coaching session, or whatever it is, at those particular times, you could kind of marinate in the experience for a minute or two or three. But most of what makes the biggest difference, it's kind of like it's almost a principle from physical fitness and cross training. It's like a lot of brief episodes of intensive practice are going to have more impact than one massed experience.
That actually makes a lot of sense. And so periodically breaking it up throughout the day and having these minute or two things of just ruminating on the good aspects of things, the stuff you want to learn, the stuff you're trying to condition into your brain, that actually is a lot more effective.
That's exactly right. You're trying to condition it into your brain. That's a super good way to say it. And to be clear again, often you're already experiencing it, right? Yep. You're already having a nice moment. You're already feeling good about yourself. You're already calming down. You already feel determined or a sense of grit, fortitude. It's already happening. Turn on the recorder.
I love that. It's kind of like having these conversations like now with you and some of the other experts. It's like sometimes I have these conversations, I get on the phone with these guys and some of my friends are, big name people. It's like we have these incredible conversations and so many people could learn like some great information. Why not just throw the recorder on while we're at it?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I have a business background. It's funny. And I'm Scottish also in my ancestry. So there's something thrifty about that. You don't want to waste it. You want to... You know what I honestly think about this in my kind of way of is return on investment. What's your ROI on your experiences? Most people's ROI, return on investment on their experiences, is zero. They don't gain anything. It might be a nice experience in the moment, but there's no gain on it. It's not earning him any money, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny, it goes back to this line in business. What's the most expensive piece of equipment? It's the one that's not making any money for you. We have all these experiences, we don't gain from them. How can you gain from them? And this is at the heart of who you're becoming, right?
Yeah.
This is the front end that you and I are talking about here of who you are becoming as a man and a person in the next day, in the next year, over the course of your whole life. This is how to control and influence who you are becoming for your own sake and that of other people.
So in the book, is this kind of the core philosophy of how to acquire these different things, like the grit, the toughness? I think there's 12 vital strengths that you talk about in the book. Is this really the focus of it, is getting these things into your life?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. If you want to have any kind of lasting well-being in a changing world, you need resilience. So, and to have resilience, you have to have strengths inside. So then the question is how to acquire them, like you and I are talking about, how to grow them. You're exactly right. So in the book, especially the strength of learning, which for me is the strength of strengths. And when I say learning, I mean so much more than memorizing a phone number or, you know, the multiplication tables. I'm talking about emotional learning, body learning, motivational learning, how to be motivated, you know, and how to build in habits, how to change, how to develop good habits fundamentally that are in you and you don't have to keep exercising your willpower for. So learning is one of the 12 fundamental resources, fundamental strengths that you need for resilience, and it's the one that grows the rest of them. So it's like the engine that grows the rest of them. But once you have that engine, you can then use that engine to grow mindfulness, compassion, gratitude, grit, motivation, intimacy, courage, aspiration. These are some of the other strengths I get into, as you know. And as a result of that, I'm really happy about this book. It's really the summary of like 50 years of hardcore focus on the down and dirty of personal healing and growth and self-reliance, really the essence of self-reliance. And in it is a fair amount of is a kind of woven in as a certain mindfulness perspective. And in it as well, it's grounded in how your brain evolved and our three needs as animals to be safe, to be satisfied, and to be connected. But the crux of the book is very simple and direct, and it's really down to earth in how it's written. So I know I'm pitching my book here. Sorry about that. But actually, I feel happy about it, and I just am kind of saying that.
No, it's awesome. I'm going to get a copy myself, actually, too, right after this, because I just think all this stuff is incredibly fascinating. And especially when we start to talk about some of the science behind it and the brain and how it all works and, you know, the neurotransmitters, et cetera, it's just really cool. That's kind of where I live, is that home and connecting the two, like the emotional side and the actual scientific side.
That's great.
You know, what you do.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it, to put those two together? Yeah, we're doing the same thing.
As far as motivation, you brought that up. It sounds like it seems like something that either or some people actually have told me this, like, how do I get more motivated? They think it's something that comes from within, and it's something that people either have or they don't have. Like, they're either lazy or they're super motivated to be rich and to be successful or to be happy. How do you develop that? Because you're saying something, and I believe that, by the way. I believe what you're saying, but how do you develop that trait of motivation?
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, you're right about the innate part. They're like the one-third, two-thirds.
Yeah.
So the one-third is real. And here's a really useful piece of information about your brain in terms of motivation. To stay motivated easily, it really helps to have an ongoing trickle of dopamine activity in your brain. Mm-hmm. That's what helps people stay motivated. Without that, yeah, you can give yourself willpower. You can also beat yourself up, but that's not any long-term basis for motivation. But here's the problem. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical that is related to the sense of reward or for tracking rewards, right? Stay motivated. The problem is that dopamine is a little molecule in the little connections between brains, it's called between neurons called synapses. Those connections are like little docking stations. So the receptors receive these molecules like little container vessels scooting into the docks of the synapses. Okay. there is normal genetic variation in how many dopamine receptors are built inside typical neurons. Some people are naturally genetically build a lot of dopamine receptors. Other people naturally genetically build very few dopamine receptors. The practical result is this. If you have a lot of dopamine receptors, it doesn't take a lot of stimulation or reward to give you a dopamine experience and keep you going down the path of motivation. But if you don't have many dopamine receptors, you use up your dopamine supplies quickly and you need a lot of stimulation and novelty again and again and again to keep you motivated down the road. My dad, for example, had, I'm sure, a million dopamine receptors. He grew up on a ranch in North Dakota. He became a cowboy, then a fishing game guy, then he became a zoologist eventually. And he was the kind of guy that could just stay motivated for hours, fixing barbed wire fence, one wire after another, you know? He just keep on going. My mom was totally different. She has very few dopamine receptors, and she needed constant stimulation. So you see, naturally, people that are more persistent, like turtles, they have lots of dopamine receptor type. On the other hand, you see spirited, maybe hyperactive, ADD, attention deficit type people. They're more toward the jackrabbit end of the spectrum. They have fewer dopamine receptors, and they need a lot of stimulation to stay motivated. That's really useful to know about yourself. And also as a takeaway point, this is how humans are designed to be, including in hunter-gatherer bands. It's useful to have some turtles, some jackrabbits, and a lot of people in the minute in a band. The problem is, if you're a kid who's a jackrabbity kid who just doesn't have a lot of dopamine receptors and needs a lot of novelty and excitement and stimulation and intensity, you go to a typical turtle school run by turtles, taught by turtles to try to train you into becoming a turtle, that's going to screw up your head. There's going to be a lot of criticism, a lot of frustration. You're not going to be that good at being a turtle, right? And you're getting in trouble, and then your parents get in the mix, and hey, what a mess. It's really important to appreciate it was not your fault. It was a problem of fit. You know, put a jackrabbit in a turtle pen, that's not a good fit. So now as an adult, what do you do? And there are a lot of implications for this, including if you're a leader, how do you motivate a team that includes some turtles, some jackrabbits, and some folks in the middle? And if by nature you're more of a jackrabbit kind of person, what do you do? And that's where, to me, a little bit of practical neuropsychology comes in. You don't need to, I don't understand exactly everything about how my car works, but I understand enough about the engine that makes me a better driver. And I can deal also with weird situations to some extent. So with your own brain, if you are this kind of person and you think, whoa, Rick's talking about me, one, you're normal. There's nothing wrong with you. It was wrong with your school, or your teachers didn't understand you, or your parents didn't get it, even though they were well-intended. One. Two, look for ways to increase the rate of stimulation in your day, including, for example, if you want to help yourself meditate and you get bored in a minute, find ways to meditate that have more stimulation. Listen to a guided meditation. Walk, move. Meditate while you're walking the dog. Meditate on something more interesting than the breath, like feelings of gratitude. Just focus on gratitude. Meditate on gratitude. Or meditate on, your friends, the sense of friendship with your friends. Let that be your object of attention instead of something as kind of boring and repetitive as the breath. At work, look for ways to break up your day so it keeps you stimulated. If you're stuck in a long meeting, find ways to keep it interesting. Imagine the people in the room with no clothes on, or whatever else you do, without being creepy, of course. Point out to yourself what you've accomplished, all these little steps along the way. Draw your attention to the completion of all these little tasks. One email at a time, one conversation at a time, one meeting at a time. That'll help you stay with it. These are general points. I can get into more detail about how to train your brain to be naturally more inclined in the direction you want to send it in, right? And that you want it to be habitually drawn into. But this is a good start, thinking about yourself and your nature and how you can give your brain the rewards it needs so it'll keep going in the direction you want it to go in.
Yeah, I think these are all really beneficial steps to take in as far as staying motivated, especially for people who tend to be more ADD-like or have less dopamine receptors.
Yeah.
Have you come across, I'm curious, have you come across the or heard anything about supplementing with things like tyrosine to build more dopamine?
Yeah, I have actually. There's not a, so tyrosine or tyrosine, you're right, is the precursor. It's like the chemical that the body eats and then builds dopamine out of, as you know. So I've looked into that. There's not strong research support for that on average. On the other hand, I think there is a lot of natural variation in the population. So different people get from gain from different things. And if the risk of an intervention is low, the evidence basis for it doesn't need to be high. If you're going to take medication that could be lethal if you don't do it really carefully, yeah, there needs to be good evidence for that. But if you're going to try a natural chemical that the body eats, it's in our food, it exists naturally in the body, and you're going to try to see if it helps, cool. You know, check it out. The one area where there is good research evidence for this kind of thing, as you may well know, is with what's called tryptophan, or the next step in the chain towards serotonin, 5-hydroxytryptophan. If a person is grappling with depressed mood, or sort of mildly depressed mood, or they're really reactive to stress, it's interesting for people listening to this to just look it up online and, you know, look into sensible MDs who are writing about this kind of thing and dosages, levels, and cautions and things like that. But there's good research that supports the usage of tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan for depressed mood, especially mild to moderate depressed mood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of that. And actually, it's funny that you mentioned that right along with the dopamine, because I've heard some stuff. I don't know if it was specific studies or not, but I've heard some things online and some from some people that I know that 5-HTP and tyrosine, actually dopamine and serotonin, they use the same receptors in the brain. So they actually are competing neurotransmitters. So when you supplement with, say, 5-HTP for mild depression, and you actually want to supplement with tyrosine at a 10-to-1 ratio is what I believe, 10 times the amount of tyrosine to 5-HTP, because 5-HTP is so great, like you said, at boosting serotonin, making, you know, people feel a little happier, more content. But it also can take away some of the dopamine that's being produced. Now, is that proven scientifically? I don't think so yet, but it might be something to consider.
I've never heard of that. That's interesting. I would just say to people, these are neurochemicals. You're playing around. I mean, it's kind of like Ritalin or Prozac that are man-made. I mean, they're pretty powerful interventions. So I would just say, could be. Check it out. Technically, I'm not sure I'd say that dopamine receptors are the same as serotonin receptors, but I can understand how in this very complex dynamic soup of the brain, with all these factors interacting with each other and all these little R2-D2 units bustling around inside your brain, you know, in the big manufacturing plant there making things happen, I can imagine the ways in which if you supplement 5-HTP that might somehow crowd out dopamine metabolism pathways in such that it might be helpful to supplement with tyrosine. So maybe, and I'm gonna learn more about that myself. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I heard it for some pretty smart people that I've had on the show, but again, I don't think science has proven it yet, but I definitely would check it out for sure. And anyone listening, I mean, don't just dive into supplementing with either thing, you know, tyrosine or 5-HTP. Do some due diligence, as I always say, but it's very fascinating, man. There's so many different things that the brain can do and the chemicals that it produces. I think we're still in the infancy of learning it all and trying to comprehend it. But just a few more questions, man. It's been a fascinating interview. I know your time's precious. I know we were a little behind.
Yours too.
But as far as self-worth, that's another thing that you talk about, I think, in this book, right? So the Resilient book.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get a better sense of self-worth, and how do we cultivate that? Because that's another huge aspect to, obviously, happiness, contentness. How do we develop that using your protocol?
Well, first to frame it, I know a lot of people who have high self-esteem. They can list a whole bunch of positive attributes they have, and they have low self-worth. deep down, they don't feel good about themselves. They feel inadequate or less than others. There's a lot of self-doubt, maybe old feelings of shame in the mix. So developing self-worth in a healthy way is really important. It helps people feel better. It also makes them more confident in business. They're more willing to try. And it makes them less likely to be a bully. Like you and I talked about before we started today, if people don't have healthy self-worth, they, on the one hand, could have a really hungry heart, and that leads them into trying to get approval from others or quick fixes, like through, you know, sexual fleeting encounters that are problematic. Or people with that hole inside themselves can abuse other people in order to get for themselves and take for themselves. So yeah, self-worth is really important. So how to grow it, right? So there are two main pathways in, if you just think about them. So, and these are ways to have experiences that we must internalize. If you want to grow the trait of self-worth, like some people handle their self-worth issues by arranging their circumstances. So they find a partner who's really complimentary, or they get into a mutual admiration society with other people or something like that. All right, fine, maybe. But as soon as the music stops, there's nothing inside. The person has not developed the trait of self-worth over time. So that's what I'm going to talk about here. So there are two pathways into the experiences that then you can internalize. The original pathway, the main pathway, is in early childhood from the outside in. It's when others recognize your worth. Now, the recognition of your worth is available to us in many different ways, including in relationships that are not necessarily perfect. Maybe there's something else going on. I systematically listed in five different ways to feel of worth to other people. And that means that there are five different opportunities as you go through your day if you're trying to fill up your banks from the inside out. So five ways to feel of worth. First, and they kind of start easy, then they go up. Feel included. Anytime other people are deliberately including you, you're part of a team, you're part of a sports team, a work team, there's a sense of inclusion, the people on your floor, in your apartment building, camaraderie. Maybe you have a sense of shared fellowship with other people who are fans, in my case, the Golden State Warriors, a basketball team. Or maybe you have a sense like you with other people are really into doing something about global warming as best we can, et cetera. So there's a sense of camaraderie and inclusion first. Second, opportunity to feel of worth to another person or people in general is to feel seen by them. We're profoundly social animals. We're not ants. We recognize each other not by tapping each other on our antennae, but looking into each other's eyes and feeling understood, or at least feeling like people are trying to understand, or they're empathic in some basic way. Doesn't mean they agree with us, doesn't mean they're our best friend or soulmate, whatnot, but they're tuning in. There's a sense of rapport. Like you and I have a clear sense of rapport here. We've never met before. We're still doing this, and it's good. That's a nice way to feel of worth. Like you're worth being attended to. You're worth others tuning into you. That's an implicit message of worth and an opportunity.
Yeah.
Third opportunity for growing self-worth is to experience that others appreciate you. They may not like you. They may not agree with you, but they respect you, or they're grateful to you, or they chose you, or they hired you, or they selected you in some way, or they acknowledge you, they compliment you, praise you. These are opportunities to feel appreciated. Great. And a lot of them are going to be, like I've said, on the 0 to 10 scale, they're going to be ones and twos, but they're real, right? Fourth opportunity to feel of worth is that you are liked, right? That, and again, it doesn't have to be the world's best friendship, but like there's a friendliness. The guy at the deli, I think about, or buddies you've got, or a group you're part of, or someone who's affectionate in a good way with you. Pat on the back, a romantic partner who's affectionate, erotic. Those are opportunities to feel liked. And then, of course, last, loved, to feel cherished, to feel like you really are special to this person, that's a very important way to feel of worth to them. So these are opportunities to feel of worth based on experiences we're receiving. That's the one path. That's one pathway. It's the main one in early childhood as we develop ourselves. And if there were issues in early childhood or childhood in general with this pathway, and instead of this pathway, there were experiences of rejection or abandonment or criticism or shaming, let's say, of various kinds, large and small, then it's especially important to look for ways to compensate for what happened when we were young. And obviously, to the extent we care for children as adults, as fathers, say, or as friends, partners of someone who is raising a child, say, but we see this kid, we have opportunities to give them the message that we see value in them. Yeah, they need to eat their vegetables before they get dessert, but we see goodness in them. We see the good in them. All right. Then the other way in, just to finish fast, is to see good in yourself. So you can, especially this is more and more important as an adult, and it's also what you have control over, even if the world is not giving you the supplies you need. So in yourself, you can recognize that you're accomplishing things as you move through your day. You're actually successful at these things. Or you can recognize in yourself good intentions, that you're not a dick, that you have a good heart. You do believe in justice. You do believe in fair play. Yeah, you want to win, but you're willing to call it out when it's out. You're a good person. You're a good guy. That's a very important way. And to have experiences where, partly too, that's one thing I love about your whole approach, where you challenge yourself. And then when you succeed at it, you feel good. Like a main pathway for a major pathway for me to develop true self-worth in my 20s, coming up out of my childhood in which I was young and scrawny and when I went through school and routinely picked last for teams, was to discover that I'm actually pretty athletic, not a great athlete, but a decent one. And I got really interested in extreme sports like rock climbing and doing intense things in the mountains, mainly with guys. Male companions, and feeling like strong and like a dude in those environments, that was a major pathway for me to have the key experiences that you need, and then don't waste them on your brain. Take them into yourself again and again and again. So, okay, those are, and that's a main way into self-worth.
Awesome, man. Thanks, you know, for explaining that and going over that. And by the way, for the, what was it, the second or third example you gave, like the, you know, rapport that we have now, I really appreciate it because we do have a good rapport. And man, this is one of the easiest interviews I've had to do because you just, you're a great guy and, you know, I appreciate the flow we have.
Yeah, but, thank you. It's mutual. Yeah, it's great.
Just a sort of a final question, and then we'll wrap things up.
Sure.
How important is mindfulness, is meditation in this whole aspect of shaping your brain and getting this happiness and building this resiliency? How important is that, and what kind of role does that play in your life, and you know, should it play in the lives of others?
That's a great question. Wow. Well, so people use the word mindfulness in like a narrow way or a broad way. I tend to use it in the narrow traditional sense as simply sustained present moment awareness. Simple. Okay. If anybody can do it for half a breath, the trick is to do it for a whole breath or 10 breaths in a row. Sustained present moment awareness. And you can be aware of what's outside you, like the trucks driving next to you on the freeway or the expressions going across the face of someone you're trying to sell, a prospect or your partner. And you can aim this present moment awareness internally. What am I feeling inside? What's going on? What's my gut telling me here about this weird situation I'm in the middle of? So that's what mindfulness is. A broader definition, people start adding things like acceptance, self-compassion, sort of just being in the flow. I'm okay with all that. I just find, though, it's useful to distinguish the mindfulness itself from those other things, because then you can focus on what would it really help me to grow. All right. To answer your question, then, to be able to grow the good, you've got to be able to sustain attention to it. And in effect, attention is like a spotlight in a vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon, and then it sucks it into you. The old line, you are what you eat. Really, more profoundly, you are what you pay attention to, what you take into yourself. Attention is like the front end of the process of who you are becoming. So mindfulness is what enables you to be aware of where your attention is going. And it's a necessary aspect of being able to control your attention and keep it on what's useful. So you suck it into yourself. And to pull your attention away, especially given the negativity bias, from the crap that you don't want to suck into yourself. So for me, mindfulness is a necessary prerequisite for cultivation, would be a broad term. A quick, cool idea I had, I don't know if other people think it's a good one, but I think it's neat. I think of practice. How do you engage life, right? Call that inward practice. How do you practice? I don't mean like practicing the piano again and again. I mean, how do you engage life? How do you deal with situations that are far from perfect that you got to deal with in your life? How do you deal with your own mind? How do you practice? And I think practice is like a three-legged stool comprised of, and I'm going to use traditional terms because they sound neat. In Pali, the language of early Buddhism, it's called metta, sati, bhavana. And Pali is very close to Sanskrit. So metta is loving kindness, compassion, warm-heartedness. Sati is mindfulness. And bhavana is learning. It's cultivation, development over time. And to me, they come together. Having a warm heart, paying attention, growing along the way. Right? Loving, knowing, and growing all along the way. So I'm really interested in the third leg of that stool. The cultivation and growth leg of the stool is what I think a lot of people leave out. Some people's three-legged stool of practice is like a pogo stick, boing, boing, they got one thing, or stilts, you know. And I know people, man, who are good at mindfulness, and they have a cold heart, and they're not growing along the way. They're great meditators, but they're just prunes, all dried up and self-absorbed. Forget it. Anyway.
Kind of defeats the whole purpose. So what do you recommend? How often should people meditate?
Okay.
How often should they do this? Every day? Or
thanks for bringing me back to earth. I was all wandering away. It's good. Come back, Rick. Come back. So there's one thing to be mindful as you go through your day, right? And then it is true that meditation, and you find the meditation that works for you, and I could talk about that in a moment, but it is true that meditation is a great way to train mindfulness. And also meditation tends to have other benefits too. It calms down the stress chemistry in the body. And because meditation is like a deep immersion in a feeling of calm, strong well-being, which is good, neurons that fire together wire together. So it's a nice opportunity to kind of marinate in a good way of being, a sense of calm well-being. That's kind of the essence of the meditative process and the result of it if you're finding a meditation that works for you. So how much? Here's my rule of thumb. A minute or more a day. Make a moral commitment. I made that commitment myself, I don't know, 15 years ago probably, to meditate a minute or more a day. Now, some people's form of meditation will be prayer. That's fine. That's call it contemplative. That's a nice fancy word. But basically, do something contemplative that's true to you and feels good to you every day for at least a minute. Now, some days, man, Justin, I've had days where I realized, whoa, just as I was crawling into bed, I hadn't meditated. And then guess what? I'm not just going to lie there and let my mind wander. That's not meditation. I'm going to sit up and actually do it for a minute at least. Maybe it's the last minute before your head hits the pillow, but it's a minute a day. And I found that that changed my life, and I think it would change a lot of people if they did that. Now, you build up from there. It is like lifting weights in the gym. There is a dosing effect. The more you do, the more impact it's going to have. But what happens, too, also, as you develop yourself over time, maybe to use an analogy like jogging, you know, running, you build up aerobic fitness that carries itself more over time. So it starts having a kind of momentum. And if you want to train yourself, you get the benefits of training more rapidly. Like just factually, I like a lot of people who've meditated for a while, very rapidly can drop into, boom, calm well-being. And with a little practice, like saying to myself, okay, I'm going to really do this now for half an hour or more, the deep end of the pool. pretty fast. But that's based on training. And research supports that. You change your brains. You really do change your brain over time. But the thing I would really stress to people, find the thing you'll do and then stick with it. And vary it. If your mind is more jackrabbity, vary it to or do what works for you to help you zone into that calm, strong place. For some people, it'll be like they're doing Qigong or Tai Chi, or they're doing some kind of maybe slow weight training, but they're staying fully present. As long as you're fully present, you're meditating. And the rest is details.
Yeah. Even, you know, yoga too, for that matter. The easiest, simplest way I've found to meditate too, because it was kind of tough for me to get into it when I first started a couple of years back. But recently, over the last like year or so, is just focusing on my breath. That's like basic, yeah, like basic 101 stuff, but it helps. I mean, I do it probably 3 to 4 times a week for like 15 to 20 minutes, and it's pretty easy to do. But even you're saying it's just a minute a day, which is a lot easier than that. I mean, I could even go back to that and just do it every day.
Well, the more you do, the better. And you're totally right. And the breath is great for lots of good reasons. One reason is that as you rest your attention on and you stay with a little bit of technical language that you might find useful from the ancient meditative traditions. We're talking thousands of people over thousands of years being really hardcore. They're sometimes described as the Olympic athletes of mental training. I mean, they were hardcore. Wow. What can we learn from them? And so one of the things they talk about is the idea of applying attention, let's say to the beginning of an inhalation, and then sustaining attention, its duration. And a teacher of mine had a nice metaphor from ice skating, because that's what she did, I guess, as an athlete. You plant your foot, so that's applying attention to the beginning of an inhalation, let's say. And then sustaining is like gliding the whole duration of that inhalation. And then you apply your attention to the exhalation, sustain, then you apply your attention to the inhalation, breath after breath. And where a lot of the value is after the third or fourth breath in a row, when you actually have to bring some effort to it. And you can watch your brain, your mind wants to pop away. And instead, it's kind of like building muscles. It's like the first three times you lift the weight, you don't build much strength. But it's when you start to fatigue that you actually start building capacity inside. Yeah, yeah, that's great.
Love it. Rick, it's been an awesome interview, man. I really do appreciate your time. What's the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave our audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out more about your work and your books?
Thank you for that. Well, I'd say fundamentally, it's great to know that no one can stop you from growing the good inside yourself, even in the worst possible life. The harder your life, the more you need to tap into what you and I are talking about. Right? This is not just for people who are privileged. It's not the cherry on the frosting on the cake. This is hardcore, from the inside out, bottom up, self-reliance. How do you develop yourself over time to become happier, not just stronger? I mean, we're strong as a means to an end. But no one can stop you from doing this. That's incredibly good news. But no one can do it for you, which makes it real. You earn the results. And I love that. I'm a very autonomous, independent, scruffy kind of guy. And I don't like being pushed around. And it's great to know that deep down inside your own mind, and therefore your brain, you are the boss. You are the keeper of the temple. You can control what gets in there, and you run the temple and deep down inside yourself. And no one can stop you, but no one can do it for you. And I find that super good news, especially these days when so many people feel pushed around by external forces. All the social media messages coming in, ping, 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 constant interruption, media, weird politics, big forces that feel like you can't do anything about them. It's great to know in that context that deep down inside yourself, you really are the author. You really can be the author of who you are becoming.
That is such a great line. And the funny thing is, I just finished wrapping up a book that's coming out in the next, 6 months or so. But that is like the last line of the book is, you know, rewriting your own story because you're the author of your own story.
That's fantastic.
I love that line, man. You stole that right from me.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, man, that just said I ripped him off.
I appreciate it, man. What's the website to check out the books you have? Resilient, and then a couple of the other ones, the Buddha's Brain and Hardwiring Happiness.
Yeah, and I've got a bunch of free material and also some really great online programs that are highly accessible. And anybody with financial issues who can't afford them, we really love giving them away. We don't mind people paying for them. They're not expensive. But we also really believe in helping the most disadvantaged people here in America and also around the world. So you can go to my website, rickhanson.net. RickHanson.net. Also, anytime you want, you could just Google my name and it'll pull that up.
Awesome. Guys, make sure you check them out. I'm going to get the latest book, Resilient, right after this call. And by the way, all of the links to this will be in the show notes. This and all podcast episodes, if there's ever a book mention or, you know, website mention, all of it's right in the show notes, whether you're on iTunes or right on the website. But make sure you check him out. His book seems incredible. I can't wait to read it myself. And then, of course, his other books, which were New York Times bestsellers and incredibly successful and popular. Rick, thanks so much again for coming on, man. I really do appreciate it. I had a blast with this interview, and I know our guys are going to love this one.
Oh, I'm glad. Really, in any way I can help, I want to.
Thanks, man. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.